The American Revolution culminated in what the Constitution describes as the blessings of liberty. Yet our nation, conceived in liberty, also had a growing slave population. This is one of many contradictions that historian Eric Foner explores in his new book, The Story of American Freedom. The book also examines the debates and struggles that have extended the meaning of freedom over the centuries. Foner is a professor of history at Columbia University and the author of books about the Civil War and Reconstruction. He writes that today, when Americans are asked to define freedom, they turn to the Bill of Rights, especially the First Amendment. Yet, he says, the Bill of Rights aroused little enthusiasm upon ratification and for decades was all but ignored.
It's only in the 20th century, I think, that the Bill of Rights came to be seen as an emblem or as a defining characteristic of American freedom. As I mentioned in the book, the 50th anniversary of the Bill of Rights in 1841 was unnoticed by anybody. The 100th anniversary in the 1890s, really, there were no celebrations. It was really in the 20th century and through the struggles of groups, for example, like the IWW and its fight for the right to freedom of speech, birth control advocates and how they were fighting against laws preventing the dissemination of information about birth control, and then a reaction against the Red Scare of World War I and the suppression of civil liberties and freedom of speech during World War I, that a concept of civil liberties as really central to American freedom began to emerge. And then again in World War II, it's in World War II that the government really promotes the Bill of Rights as a central element of American freedom in contradistinction to the suppression of liberties by the Nazis. So again, one of my themes, not only with the Bill of Rights, but by many elements of American freedom, is that this is an evolutionary process. It's not that we established freedom at the time of the Revolution or the Constitution and we've just been sort of working out its logic. This is history, in other words, and freedom itself has a history. And today, it's much more central to our thinking than it was at many other points in American history.
You mentioned that the IWW, the labor movement that was the industrial workers of the world, was really important to the fight for freedom of speech and the emphasis on the First Amendment. What do you think the labor movement did in terms of calling attention to the First Amendment?
Well, there are two ways in which the labor movement, I think, plays a central role in this history of ideas about freedom in the United States. One is just the right to organize, the right to strike, the right to picket, the right to hold street corner meetings. There's a long history of freedom of expression in this country, but there's also a long history of repressing unpopular ideas. And the IWW, which was a radical, you know, labor group in the early part of this century, came up against local ordinances, sometimes state laws, making it impossible for them to organize, to mobilize, to hold meetings and propagate their views. And they violated those regulations. They went to jail, sometimes were very brutally treated in jail, and they fought against these regulations in the name of freedom of expression. And these fights galvanized a lot of other people who weren't IWW members to realize that, you know, freedom of everybody believes in freedom of speech for themselves. But that's not freedom from my point of view. It's when you when unpopular ideas can be expressed freely that this kind of liberty actually operates. And the IWW was one of the first groups to forthrightly challenge these regulations on unpopular speech. And the other way in which the labor movement, IWW and many others, play a role in this book is by expanding what you might call a different element of freedom, which is economic freedom. Economic freedom is a central element all the way through American history, but its meaning has changed many times. Today, economic freedom usually is invoked as equivalent to the free market, lack of government regulation, not paying taxes, things like that. The labor movement has always put forward a more substantive and positive vision of economic freedom as, in the 20th century, having an American standard of living, having a voice in economic decision-making, economic security for ordinary people. These are also definitions of freedom, which the labor movement and others have put forward as an alternative to just the sort of free market vision.
What did the birth control movement do early in the century to help define freedom of speech?
Well, the birth control movement in the early part of this century challenged laws which made it illegal to declared birth control information obscene, basically, and made it illegal to disseminate information about birth control. The post office particularly suppressed any mention of birth control devices or anything like that in newspapers or pamphlets that went through the mail. And people like Margaret Sanger, for example, were very important, again, in highlighting the repression of free speech in the name of morality, in the name of, middle-class propriety, by the government, by the Post Office Department, by local judges, and really the right to disseminate this information. Now, of course, it had a feminist tinge to it, because the idea was women could not truly be considered themselves free if they did not have the right to control their own childbearing. And so it was not only freedom of expression, but you might say freedom of control of your own body, which the birth control movement put forward as an essential element of freedom. And I think people like Sanger and others played a very important role in expanding this notion of freedom to personal life, to private life, to intimate relations, areas for which it wasn't really intended by, let us say, the founding fathers.
Now, you write about World War I being very important in changing a lot of things in America, and you say the wartime language inspired this sense of freedom and the desire for freedom for African Americans. W.E.B. Du Bois called on Black Americans to close ranks and enlist in the segregated army to help, quote, make our own America a real land of the free. But then you say Black soldiers felt betrayed when they returned, and that sense of betrayal helped spur on the movement for freedom.
Well, African Americans have always had a somewhat different, you might say, experience and angle of vision about what freedom is than whites. I think this is a gross generalization, which there are many exceptions to, but I would say white Americans, by and large, have always believed that freedom is something they have and that someone is trying to take away, whether it's the federal government, the Trilateral Commission, Masons, conspirators, communists. Somebody's always attacking our freedom. Black Americans, because of their particular historical experience, tend to believe that freedom is something you have to aspire to. It's something that hasn't quite been achieved. It's something in the future. It's a process. It's a struggle. And wars have always been a key moments in which, to mobilize the population, the government puts forward very strongly ideas of America as a democratic society. In World War I, this was the war to make this world safe for democracy. World War II was fought for the four freedoms, according to President Roosevelt. And blacks, you know, basically said, well, what about us? What about a little democracy at home for us? What about the four freedoms at home in a segregated society? But the hope that this rhetoric will actually become meaningful for them has led many blacks to enlist in the armies and also to make very substantive gains. After all, emancipation came out of the Civil War. World War I led to a tremendous sense of betrayal. Blacks fought in the segregated army. They demanded that the rhetoric of democracy be brought home. But, of course, the Wilson administration had no interest whatsoever in doing that. Segregation didn't end. The disenfranchisement of black voters didn't end. In fact, very often in 1919, returning black soldiers found themselves attacked by mobs. There were soldiers lynched in uniform. It certainly seemed that the war to make the world safe for democracy somehow didn't apply to the South in the United States, let's put it that way.
Does the Constitution, which you know so well, ever feel at all to you like a tainted document because the Founding Fathers, when they talked about we the people or, you know, freedom for all, that knowing that they were just really talking about white men?
Well, I think we have to take the Constitution as a starting point, not as a fixed document, which is, you know, always going to be the same. The meaning of the phrases, the Constitution was written very ambiguously. There are phrases in there like due process of law or, you know, freedom of speech, et cetera, which mean many different things at different periods in our history. The Constitution is a sort of a general blueprint. It is not an absolute guide for action. And I think we have to take the original Constitution as a beginning point, but also understand how many great struggles have taken place in American history of groups that were not included in the Constitution to gain the blessings of liberty, to gain acceptance into the realm of we the people, and how those struggles have, as I said, changed what freedom is for everybody in this country, not just for the people themselves. So the Constitution is a beginning point. It's not the end of American history, and it's not the end of our thinking about what America ought to be.
Would you think it's fair to say that there has never been a point in American history where freedom for all could be taken for granted?
I don't believe freedom can ever be taken for granted at any point in history, American or otherwise. You know, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, who was an abolitionist who commanded black soldiers during the Civil War, said, "Revolutions may go backward." In other words, history is not just a straight line of progress. Rights can be achieved and rights can be taken away. And another often quoted sentence about freedom, which has a lot of historical truth, this was said by an Irish jurist in the 18th century, is the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. In other words, it's not you can never take your rights, your freedoms for granted. And certainly the history of African Americans in this country underscores that very well, because during the Civil War and Reconstruction, the realm of freedom was tremendously expanded for Black Americans. But in the generations after that, many of those rights were simply rescinded, taken away, and a whole new system of racial injustice was imposed. So history doesn't, unfortunately, just move in a straight line toward greater and greater freedom. Sometimes it moves towards lesser and lesser freedom.
As we near the end of the century, what are the freedoms in America that you think are being debated now?
Well, I think that at the end of my book, I, to be very modern and up to date, although I'm kind of a low-tech kind of person, I went to the internet and searched for freedom using some search mechanisms. And I found what I guess you would suspect anyway, that today the notion of freedom is very much associated with anti-government activists. These are militia units. They are people who don't want to pay taxes. They are free marketeers. And to some extent, I think the notion of freedom has become denuded of many of its traditional meanings. I would like to see for the next century some older American traditions of freedom reinvigorated, such as freedom as economic security, freedom as liberating dispossessed people or people against whom there's discrimination, liberating them from unjust restrictions on their lives. Today, freedom is often posed against government, but there have been many points in our history when government has been, as Charles Sumner, the abolitionist, said, the custodian of freedom, where weak, dispossessed groups have looked to government activism to actually expand their freedom. And I think we have to get away from this current notion that the way to that freedom means getting government off your back. You know, when Martin Luther King ended his great 1963 speech at the Lincoln Memorial, you know, free at last, thank God Almighty, I'm free at last. He wasn't just talking about paying low taxes, you know. He was talking about a vision of freedom as, you know, as equality, as empowerment, as dignity in the society, as really being treated fully as an equal human being. And I think we have to try in the next century to think about ways, given the changes in the market and the global economy and others, ways to reinvigorate those older but still very American notions of what freedom is and can be.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Foner. He's a professor of history at Columbia University and author of the new book, The Story of American Freedom. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eric Foner, author of The Story of American Freedom and professor of history at Columbia University. The House Judiciary Committee has a grave responsibility now, deciding whether to go forward with impeachment hearings. And I'd like to ask you a little bit about your thoughts on this matter. You've studied American history for a long time. Do you think that we have impeachable offenses before us?
Well, of course, nobody quite knows what the Founding Fathers meant when they put into the Constitution high crimes and misdemeanors as the grounds for impeachment. I think it's fair to say they didn't have in mind exactly what's being considered today. And I think I don't see anything in the Starr Report or other such documents that to strike me as impeachable offenses. My opinion of I think the president has been revealed to be a rather sophomoric kind of character. But most people seem to feel that lying about personal sexual matters is not a crime against the state. In other words, what the Constitution had in mind about impeachable offenses were abuses of office and crimes against the community, crimes against the state. That's why Andrew Johnson was impeached during Reconstruction, because of a very principled battle over what the future shape of American society should be after the Civil War, about Reconstruction, about the rights of Black people. The kind of matters under consideration now, I think, really don't measure up to what, you know, the process, the very severe process of impeachment really was intended to deal with. This does not mean one must admire the president's behavior, but impeachment is not the it was not put forward as a remedy for every mistake, every stupid action, and every misjudgment by a president. If that were the case, every president in our history would have been impeached.
What's your impressions of how Kenneth Starr has handled his role of special prosecutor?
I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not a judge, and I certainly wouldn't like to have Kenneth Starr investigating me, believe me. Not that I'm guilty of the acts that Clinton is, but I don't think
that... Well, that was
going
to be my next question. We were going to go
into
that.
Well, what I'm saying is that one of the reasons there's a lot of sympathy for President Clinton, even among people who are kind of disgusted by his behavior, is that nobody would like to see their private life investigated in this way, that we still do believe that there is this realm of privacy. That's why when Clinton's testimony before the grand jury was put out on TV and the internet, it turned people against Starr, because they just imagined themselves sitting there for 4 hours with some intrepid prosecutor investigating their personal sexual behavior. People think that itself is distasteful, and I think that's correct. You know, there are many precedents in American history for this. You can go back to a lesser-known figure, but very similar to Starr, Anthony Comstock, who was a special agent of the post office in the late 19th, early 20th century, whose job was to root out sin in society, just like Starr seems to think it's his job, and who was one of the main prosecutors of the birth control movement in trying to keep information like that from public dissemination, and arranged for the arrest of birth control advocates, etc., and also suppressing what was considered obscene literature or poetry or novels or anything like that. Just like Starr, Comstock, in the act of trying to suppress this material, actually distributed it far more widely than it would have really been before that, because he had to demonstrate how evil it was. And you get this, the Starr Report to me is part of a long tradition in this country of what I call Puritan pornography, where people who want to root sin out from society create pornographic literature, basically, where they can enjoy reading it, but they don't feel they're sinning because they are actually trying to suppress someone else's sins. So in the 19th century, for example, anti-Catholic literature often dwelled obsessively on mostly imaginary offenses that nuns and priests were committing behind closed doors, you know. And this would be widely distributed, and people who were completely upstanding middle-class citizens would read this and get very titillated, but they didn't really think there was anything wrong with it, because we're trying to really root out sin of Catholics. Same thing with Comstock and his expose and suppression of sexually explicit material in the early 20th century. And when I read the Starr Report, it just put me back into those days. Somehow you think nothing ever changes. Here's an upstanding, God-fearing, moral man who is distributing the most salacious and pornographic stuff to a mass audience, but yet doesn't think there's anything wrong with that, because his motive is to root out sin from our society.
I think a lot of Americans are wondering now, is our president supposed to be a good role model, a man of good character? How important is that? Or is the only thing that's important the kind of policies that they enact?
Presidents are role models. And whether we like it or not, people look up to presidents and children and adults, and they do think that presidents should behave themselves in an upstanding manner. On the other hand, most Americans, being adult, realize that no person is a saint, and that it seems that we look to presidents nowadays for political leadership and economic leadership, and that, I guess, is as it should be. We live in an age of expose, which is far greater than any time in our past. But of course, everybody knows if we started investigating the personal lives of all the previous presidents, we would find many examples of of deviations from the straight and narrow course. But I think most people feel we elect a president to run the country, and if the president is doing a good job, I would much rather see Clinton criticized for his policies on welfare or gays in the military or health care or whatever other public issue is facing the country than this obsessive interest in, his private sexual behavior.
Eric Foner, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure, always to be here.
Eric Foner is a professor of history at Columbia University and author of the new book, The Story of American Freedom.